It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Sunday, April 21st, 2024. I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Gas prices are headed in the wrong direction, and on top of the cost of everything else, it's frustrating Americans. But what can President Biden do about it now, and will he do anything about the costs in an election year?
I think they're going to pull out all the stops to do everything they can politically to bring gas prices down, even though it'll probably be for a short-term political gain and not really good for America.
A jury's been seated in the New York hush money trial of former President Trump, with many of the jurors expressing not just open minds, but some even said they don't have strong feelings about the former president.
Some people are into the business of getting through their days, which they think is more important than like Donald Trump and other stuff that consumes us.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington. Gas prices are creeping back up. Heading into the weekend, AAA had the average price per gallon nationally at $3.67. That's about where it was a year ago, and people are frustrated, especially when they consider the cost of all other goods.
I mean, that hurts. I'm like a handyman, so that's probably half a job, you know what I mean? So that means I just got to do more jobs.
Our gas prices are ridiculous. You know, I've been driving since I was 16, and I'll be 62 next month. It's just ridiculous, the prices that we have.
Still, things have creeped up over time, and the grocery and gas bill is still up there.
Paycheck's not rising. It's staying the same, so eventually, then it takes about 2 or 3 checks just to cover all the bills instead of just one.
White House spokeswoman Karine Jean-Pierre said Friday they were monitoring prices and noted that the president had tapped into the Strategic Petroleum Reserve before.
We are focused on securing energy supply and, like I said, lowering prices for Americans. The United States' current record domestic oil and gas production is helping meet our immediate needs while we make the historic investment needed to transition into clean energy economy. But obviously, we're going to continue to watch the markets carefully.
Economic advisor to the president, Lael Brainard, was also asked about what the president might do to combat rising prices at the Semaphore World Economy Summit. She said the goal was to keep prices within current ranges.
We're keeping a very close eye on gas prices at the pump, and also, of course, some of the events in the Middle East. There's geostrategic risk, and we'll continue to monitor. There are, of course, things that have been done in the past, and we'll continue to very closely monitor, make sure that gas prices remain affordable for so many American families going into the summer driving season.
It is an election year, and the president's energy secretary, Jennifer Granholm, told The View this past week that the president is obsessed with gas prices. And many analysts say he should be.
You know, I know the Biden administration is already worried about it. And if you look at, you know, what people are saying about gasoline prices on the surge back up again, back to last year levels, they are not happy.
Phil Flynn is a senior account executive at the Price Futures Group and a Fox Business contributor.
When you look at the gasoline prices, it's only part of the equation. When they go to the grocery store, when they go, you know, out to a restaurant, the rising gasoline prices is just more pain. And usually when you're feeling pain at the gas pump and in the grocery checkout line, you usually blame the guy who's in charge. And so I'm sure the Biden team is probably losing a little bit of sleep about these rising prices.
Yeah, Moody's Analytics put out this report that says they do think President Biden will beat former President Trump in the fall. But if gas prices get close to $4, that the election will go to Trump. What is it about gas prices that they have this much power? Or is it kind of to your previous point that it's more of a topper on an economic pile?
You know, I think it's the topper, but seriously, I think one of the most emotional issues when it comes to finances is people at the gas pump, you know, and I get a lot of calls when prices go up. Oh, Phil, are they ever going to come down? Because it's so integral in the part of people's lives. It's their jobs. It's their happiness. It's their vacation. Mm-hmm. And when it gets expensive, it really cuts in. But when we talk about the risk, the political risk, I think more than any president in history, President Biden owns these high gasoline prices, right? You know, we all remember the stickers of, you know, President Biden pointing to the gas price. I did that. But when you look at President Biden's rhetoric when it came to, you know, shutting down big oil and, you know, putting on new regulations and flipping everybody to electric cars and basically blaming people, you know, hey, if you don't like the gas prices, it's your fault because you didn't buy an electric car. That's not going to play well on Main Street. So I think they're going to have significant problems. I agree with Moody's. And I think they're going to pull out all the stops to do everything they can politically to bring gas prices down, even though it'll probably be for a short-term political gain and not really good for America.
You say President Biden owns this more than any other president, maybe in modern times, right? But you look at the profits that oil and gas companies have made. Maybe 2023 wasn't as good a year as 2022, but they're still pretty high. And you also look at the number of permits that the Biden administration has approved at the same time. Maybe they're not approving as many leases, or I should say selling as many leases, but the permits are higher under this administration than the previous one, even if that's he has no choice. And once you have the lease and you have to permit it, I'm not sure exactly how that works. But, you know, I'm imagining the Biden administration would push back on you and say, wait a second, you know, oil companies are doing really well. There's lots of permits for drilling. Crude production in 2023 broke a record. It was higher than in 2019.
Right. And you're exactly right. I mean, the Biden administration is going to point to these talking points and try to convince Americans, hey, look, we're great for American energy. Hey, how's your environmental base going to like that? Right. You know, I thought you were trying to shut down fossil fuels. But you know what? It's all misleading. Listen, President Biden can do all he wants and try to convince America like he did before. He can demonize the U.S. energy industry and saying, you know, they're making record profits. They're war profiteers. They're gouging you at the pump. But the reality is that the record profits that I'm more worried about is the record profits that are being made in Iran. One of the reasons why Iran's oil exports hit a six-year high. They're bringing in more revenue into Iran from oil prices than they've had, you know, in many, many years. And a lot of that is because of the policies by the Biden administration failing to enforce sanctions, right? And generally, oil companies, when prices go up, have to make more money to continue to invest to meet demand. That's how the market works, right? Because you don't invest when you're losing money. You pull back. And the problem is that the Biden administration, with their record amount of regulations, threats and slander of the industry, has discouraged investors from investing in fossil fuels, which is going to give more power to our adversaries like Iran and, believe it or not, Venezuela.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of Venezuela, sanctions went back on Venezuela this past week.
Right.
I guess he's taking that off the table. What does that signal? I mean, are we going to have even higher prices because of that, or is that negligible?
I think it's negligible at this point. And this is the funny thing. I mean, when we talk about the sanctions on Venezuela, the Biden administration desperately lifted sanctions on Venezuela so the U.S. oil companies could get in there and fix their production. And even if they put the sanctions back on, it's not going to impact Venezuelans' oil's exports at all. So it's kind of a saving face maneuver because the Biden administration is taking a lot of heat for letting Iran to get away with murder, you know, and the U.S. oil and gas industry, you know, has a different opinion on the Biden administration, you know, record, you know, oil production. They're saying that Biden's policies are creating the energy crisis of the future. It's happening now. People say, hey, Biden, record oil production. People don't realize the investment to get that oil production did not happen under Joe Biden, okay? It takes years,
right.
Years, literally years to bring this online, and it happened in the previous administration. We're seeing signs that because of the Biden administration's policies, energy production is going to peak in the United States and start going down. Where we're not going to see it go down is in places like OPEC and places like that. And so we're going to be losing market share to other countries, and they don't produce the oil as cleanly as they do here at home.
You mentioned Iran. You know, Phil, we are in a very fraught time, right? The president pulled oil out of reserves after Russia attacked Ukraine. If things escalate in the Middle East more, and to that point, you know, you have Iran, not the Houthis, not some proxy, but Iranian forces taking over ships in the Strait of Hormuz. We just saw that this past weekend. How high could prices go? I mean, doesn't like a fifth of global oil production go through that strait or some?
It does. It does.
Quite a bit. You know, okay. Yeah.
Quite a bit. I mean, listen, you're talking about the Red Sea, and if you talk about the Strait of Hormuz, which is right on the border of Iran, that they are threatening this week to shut down if Israel attacks them, it's more than a quarter of the daily supplies. And we could see the mother of all price spikes if that actually happened, right? So we do have to be on guard. And I think the market is taking it pretty easy right now because they're hopeful that this can be avoided. But you cannot take this risk off the table. And when we talk about Iran, we talk about the Houthi rebels, and we talk about Hezbollah, we talk about the major problems in the world, most of this is being caused by Iran funding these guys, right? And yeah. The only reason Iran has the ability to fund these guys is because their oil production is hitting a six-year high. So that is the only reason that is happening. If we were able to shut down their oil revenue, the world would be a more peaceful place because these guys wouldn't have the ability nor the funding to carry out all these terror acts that we've had to live with for the last year. And it's been getting worse, not better.
Phil, do you think this president doesn't want to do that, right? If the goal is to keep gas prices down and oil is a global commodity, right? We put it on the market. It's not like every country gets to keep it for themselves. I imagine he doesn't want to limit Iran's supply. He wants to find maybe other ways to punish Iran while still keeping the oil flowing. Is that a fair thought?
You can bet your sweet oil barrel on that. Absolutely. You know, listen, I mean, Joe Biden, I hate to say it, came into office with this false perception that he could just, you know, yell at Saudi Arabia and call him a pariah state, and we can, you know, just yell at the U.S. oil and gas industry. We can tell people, quit investing in fossil fuels. You know, we're going to put on new regulations. We're going to kill the Keystone Pipeline. We're going to put on, you know, massive drilling regulations on small oil producers that'll drive them out of business. But then on the flip side, he's like, well, oil producers, come on, guys, you're not doing your part. You know, you got to be Americans. It's like, what do you want, right? You come up with regulations trying to put these guys out of business. And then on the flip side, then you complain when they're not producing more oil and keeping prices down. You can't have it both ways. You're either pro-U.S. oil and gas, or you're negative U.S. oil and gas. I don't think President Biden wants to go on the campaign trail and say, I'm pro U.S. oil, you know, oil and gas production, because it isn't true. He wants to shut it down, and he's doing what he can. Then when it's politically expedient, he will use oil and gas to his political advantage, either by using the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to bring down gas prices, or, you know, by basically, you know, slandering the oil industry when things don't go his way.
I was just going to ask you, so, you know, what tools does he have? You're saying the oil reserves and maybe yelling at the oil companies. But, you know, you already put sanctions on Venezuela. You don't have sanctions on Iran, at least when it comes to oil. So what are the tools in the toolbox if, for political purposes, you do want to bring gas prices down?
You have to change everything you thought about energy and everything you said about energy when you came into office. You have to acknowledge that U.S. oil and gas production is the cleanest, most efficient fuels in the world, and that we have to, at least fossil fuels, I mean, and we have to embrace the U.S. technology to make the world a safer place. That doesn't mean you can't do an energy transition, but you have to do it in a way where we can supply energy, you know, maintain global energy security, because when you don't, you see what happens. The world becomes a much more dangerous place. And I think that the Biden administration doesn't understand that, right? You know, they think, oh, if we just, you know, demonize and tax the heck out of the oil companies and we put up some, you know, some windmills and, you know, tell everybody to buy an electric car, everything's going to be okay. But the fact is that doesn't work in the real world. And I think his mistakes are in energy is one of the major factors in inflation, among other things that he's done, that has really hurt his own presidency. So he needs to retreat from the war on fossil fuels. And if he doesn't, you know, he's going to be a one-term president.
I do want your thoughts on this. This past week, there was a hearing on the LNG pause. The Biden administration put a pause on exporting liquefied natural gas to non-free trade countries, for those who weren't aware. Congressional hearing about this on Thursday. Republicans were saying this is sort of disastrous. It's causing a lot of instability and fear because Europeans are relying more on our LNG because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And our companies that are making the natural gas or producing it, I should say, they have a lot less certainty. Why do this? Is this part of the climate agenda, especially in light of the fact that we are producing so much crude oil?
It's a political sideshow by Joe Biden. Okay, it really is. I've never seen a president that uses U.S. oil and gas industry, kicks him in the teeth, you know, for his own, you know, political gain. The LNG exports that Europe desperately needs because of their energy policies in Europe, you know, where they became dependent on Russia for supplies, they're looking to the U.S. to fill that void. And what Joe Biden wants to do to appease his environmental base is saying, hey, we're going to really look at the impact of LNG production and exports on climate change. Well, Joe, I can save you a lot of time. The only reason the United States was able to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions by a record amount, more than anybody ever in the Paris Climate Accord or in the world, is because of LNG and U.S. natural gas production. We were able to replace coal plants. We were able to shut it down. We could burn it with clean natural gas. And even though it isn't the perfect fuel when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions, it's the cleanest fossil fuel in the world, and it can make dramatic changes. So this is a political football, and it's a ridiculous it's kicking the teeth to the U.S. oil and gas industry because it doesn't make sense. People make investments in oil, gas, and we have to invest trillions over the next couple of years to meet demand. But when you put in this uncertain regulatory environment, people are afraid to invest. And when people are afraid to invest, it's going to lead to shortages and sharply higher prices. So this is where we are leading with this.
It sounds like you're saying you can't have it both ways. Like, you either have to own it and say, look, yeah, we're going to have higher gas prices. That's them's the breaks. Yeah. We're going to a cleaner, you know, greener future with this climate agenda. Or you have to say, look, we need to slow down and sort of embrace what we have in oil and gas, even if the goal is to transition it. We can't transition tomorrow. It sounds like you're saying pick one or the other. You can't have both on your plate.
You can't have both on your plate. And to be honest with you, for the American people, I hope he gives up on this agenda. You know, Joe Biden may think he's trying to save the planet. He's not. I mean, his policies so far have not reduced greenhouse gas emissions at all. And if he thinks electrifying the entire country is going to make, you know, less carbon pollution, the fact is it's not. Okay. It's going to take years, you know, of building electric cars and strip mining for lithium and aluminum and, you know, redoing the power grid, that's going to take more fossil fuels than we've used, you know, probably since the Industrial Revolution just to make that transition. So we have to do this in a smarter way. And the other thing I would tell Joe Biden, you know, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve was never intended as a political piggy bank, okay? The Strategic Petroleum Reserve was invented for one reason and one reason only, to protect America and our world partners in the event of a major oil price disruption.
But
the Biden administration
that, Phil,
came in and changed the rules.
Yes.
But to be fair to the Biden administration, they tapped it after Russia invaded Ukraine, right?
Incorrect.
Oh, wrong.
See, this is what they're telling you, right? I'm sorry to
No, I thought it was what I remember.
I'm very passionate about this, but the truth is, no. Everybody said, "Oh, he had to tap it." You know, it's kind of funny. Everybody thinks, "Oh, Joe Biden, there was a war in Ukraine, he had to tap it." And boy, if oil prices were $130 a barrel, Donald Trump would have tapped it too. Well, I would argue oil prices under Donald Trump would have never hit $130 a barrel because there probably wouldn't have been a war in Ukraine. But that's a different argument, right? The truth is that in October of what year was it before? 2 years ago?
2021.
In October 2021. President Biden tapped the reserve because gasoline prices went up. Okay. That's when he started playing with it for political purposes. He also said he was trying to send a message to Saudi Arabia that if you didn't listen to us when we wanted you to raise production, we were going to teach you a lesson and we were going to release oil from our reserve. Massive bad move. Number one, there's no way the United States can compete with Saudi Arabia using their Strategic Petroleum Reserve because it's going to be empty and Saudi Arabia will still be producing oil. And I would argue that a lot of that oil that they tapped ended up getting exported to China and Europe and other places. In fact, U.S. oil exports hit a record high under Joe Biden, partly because we were emptying our Strategic Petroleum Reserve. So now, after the war, he tapped it again. But to be honest with you, even then, I would argue that there wasn't a major disruption at that point. And so when he released it before there was a major disruption, he discouraged investment in fossil fuels. And because of that, even though short term we brought down prices, if you look 3 years down the road, because the market was manipulated by the government, you know, we're not making the investments because the market doesn't think we need the oil. When they find out the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is empty and we're not getting that free oil, you're going to have a shortage.
Phil Flynn, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
The jury of former President Trump's peers that will hear the so-called hush money case against him was picked this week. It includes a salesman from Harlem who will serve as foreman, a businessman who enjoys listening to behavioral psychology podcasts, who says he does not have a strong opinion about the former president. One juror works in finance and said he thought the former president had done some good for the country, saying it goes both ways. An engineer from the Upper West Side also said he didn't have strong feelings about the former president. A technology worker said she has different views than the former president, but that it's a free country. An education worker from Harlem said she tries to avoid the news, but that she appreciates former President Trump speaks his mind. But even after all these people were seated, within 4 days, the former president left the courtroom to continue to rail against the case.
Justice is on trial. You know, the whole world is watching this New York scam.
He also mentioned that criminal trial means he does not get to attend Supreme Court arguments this coming week in his immunity case. He doesn't get to attend son Barron's graduation, and he doesn't get to campaign.
That I'm not in Georgia or Florida or North Carolina campaigning like I should be. It's perfect for the radical left Democrats. That's exactly what they want. This is about election interference. That's all it's about.
He said, as he has all week, that multiple legal scholars and writers have criticized the case, and Thursday afternoon emerged from the courtroom holding a pile of papers, presumably articles, as he read the headlines from them.
From legal experts, this is Wall Street Journal editorial, but all of these are stories from legal experts saying how this is not a case. The case is ridiculous.
One of those legal experts also thought it would take a bit longer to seat a jury.
I think as late as the end of the day on Monday, it really looked like the process was bogged down.
Andy McCarthy is a former federal prosecutor and Fox News contributor.
Looking back on it, I think probably Monday wasn't representative of how jury selection was going to go, because the first half of the day was really consumed by legal argument. And then the second half of the day, they finally got the jurors in after lunch, but it was a slog. And I think, you know, sometimes you just have to kind of get a rhythm and, you know, kind of get it in gear. And they had that by the second day. The one criticism I had, I thought that, I have a lot of criticisms of Judge Merchan, but I thought he ran an efficient jury selection process. The thing I think I'd say about it is I've been in a couple of, more than a couple, of anonymous jury trials as a prosecutor. And I get the sense that he's not as experienced at it as some. I don't think they have as many anonymous jury trials in the state system as we did in the federal system. But you really have to be very careful about not just concealing names. You have to sort of go the extra mile as far as identifying information is concerned. And I was a little bit surprised at the early reports of how much information was coming out that would make it pretty easy to identify who the jurors were, even if you didn't have their names.
And you're referring to that one woman who said that she had already been asked by her family members, are you being questioned as a possible juror because of some information that had gotten out?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And they had to replace her in the end. And then the judge since then has made an order I think is unconstitutional. He purported to order the media not to report the employers of the jurors. Now, I want to be clear. I don't think the media should report the employers of the jurors. I don't think there's any good reason to report that. But I'm talking about constitutional law now, not, you know, what prudence dictates. And I don't think a judge has any authority to tell the media what the media can report when something's on the public record. I just don't see that the judge has any authority to do that. So we'll see if that gets challenged.
Andy, tell me, there were questions for the jurors about how they felt about Trump. Did they follow him on social media? Have they been to anti-Trump events? This question threw me. Are you a supporter of or belong to QAnon, Proud Boys, Boogaloo, Oath Keepers, Antifa? I mean, this really got political. But if they moved so quickly through the process, I wonder, was there some belief in the jurors' answers that these potential jurors were being honest about who they were, but maybe even, and maybe I'm speculating here, but did they maybe get a sense that as polarized as we all think everyone is about Trump, maybe some are less so in the general population?
Well, I think that's a fair point. I think sometimes because we're in the business of news coverage, we don't appreciate how vanishingly small the number of people who are really into what we are into is in this country. You know, like on a good night, Fox has the highest ratings of any of the cable news services, right? And on a good night, you'd be lucky if 1% of the, 330 million people in the United States are tuned in, right? So that's not a criticism of Fox. It's just the way things are
following us in other places, Andy. Don't worry about it. They're online. They follow us all over the place. Yeah.
It must be my Twitter. That's it. So I just think that because we're so into, politics and news, we kind of sometimes presume everyone is, and they're not. Some people are into the business of getting through their days, which they think is more important than Donald Trump and other stuff that consumes us. I actually think that's pretty healthy for us to see every now and then. But I also think what we ought to recognize here is that part of the accelerated pace of this is accounted for by the the work that went into developing the jury questionnaire. Mm. You know, that's weeks and weeks of work that the parties do. So when the jurors come in, you don't have to start from scratch asking them everything. They fill out a, is it 42 questions with like 8 zillion sub questions that they had to fill out. And once they've done that and the lawyers can flip through it, you know an awful lot about these folks. And maybe we just didn't appreciate how much that would accelerate the process. For one little inside baseball thing on this, yeah. There's kind of two ways of picking a jury. I mean, there's a bunch of different quirks, but in cases like this that I've been involved in, there's two different ways of doing it. One is, and this is not the one that Judge Merchan used, but I've seen used a number of times, where if you have a situation where you want to get 18 jurors and each side has 10 challenges, what you do is qualify 38 people, and then you start doing the peremptory strikes. So you do enough questioning to get rid of all the challenges for cause, get to a point where you have 38 people that you can live with, and then start the strikes. That's not how Judge Merchan did it. He did it the faster way, which is you start from the beginning with every juror who comes in, and the lawyer's choice is, you know, if there's not a basis to challenge the juror for cause, then your choice is you bounce them with a peremptory challenge or you don't. Oh. And the difference in that system, and the reason it works faster, is if you have someone who seems like not ideal, but okay, you're apt to keep that person because you don't know who's coming next.
Right. You want to save your challenges.
Right. So in the other system, you know, the first system I described, you qualify everyone first. So when you finally get to the strikes, when you strike someone, you have a pretty good idea who that person's going to be replaced by. But that takes a long time compared to the way that Merchan did it. So
I feel like we're talking about like a John Grisham novel. It is a highly educated jury, right? There are a couple of even attorneys on this jury. I find that, I don't know, is that unique? Especially, is it helpful? Is it not helpful? And what's your assessment of having two attorneys on an already highly educated jury?
Yeah, so it's a case-by-case thing. There's some cases where you might want to have a lawyer, you know, for either side. I would think of like a good example would be like a money laundering structuring case where you have complicated fine.
Yeah.
And that might help. But for the most part, as a prosecutor, I hated having lawyers on the jury. And the only time I ever allowed it to happen is if we ran out of challenges or we got down to we had somebody who we absolutely could tell we needed to get rid of. And the cost of that was we didn't have enough challenges. So I'd have to live with the lawyer on the jury. The reason prosecutors hate lawyers on the jury, generally speaking, is the one place where prosecutors really influence the trial is in proposing jury instructions to the court that the court is going to give the jury at the end of the case to tell them what legal principles apply. The reason courts rely on prosecutors is just institutionally, prosecutors' offices are very good at keeping up to date what the latest legal principles are on all facets of the criminal law. So the court really comes to rely on the prosecutors when they give proposed jury instructions. And that's the most important thing in the trial because that's how the jury is supposed to evaluate the case. What I always hated as a prosecutor was I thought having a lawyer on the jury undermined my advantage in that regard. Because what you worry about is the lawyer is like a different source of legal authority inside the jury room. And the problem is if the defense lawyer tries to be a different source of legal authority, which the defense lawyer, of course, is entitled to do, I know what he's arguing and I can argue with him and I can try to persuade them. But if it's going on in the jury room, like when we don't get to be in the deliberation room. And if you get a lawyer in there who's very influential and who starts telling the jury, well, look, I know that's what the judge said, but this is how it actually works. You know, that's something that's hard. You can't really do anything to fight that, which is why I didn't like having lawyers in there.
So like when there's three lawyers in a room, you come out with four opinions, it sounds like.
Yes, right.
You know, I wanted to ask before I let you go about the actual case that the jury's about to hear. Not everything about it, right? Because that will unfold over time. But Even the AP noted that when it came to the decision to charge in this case, and I'm just going to read what they wrote, the charges of falsifying records were raised to felonies under an unusual legal theory that Trump could be prosecuted in state court for violating federal campaign finance laws. Turley's quoted in that same article as saying that that seems like a bit of a legal reach. Others, of course, disagree. But that is of note, right? We're used to hearing about campaign finance violations being in, you know, not in state court. Is that a technicality that matters?
It matters a great deal. First of all, Bragg, as a state prosecutor, I do not believe has authority to enforce federal campaign finance law. Constitutionally speaking, those are laws that are enacted by Congress that empower the executive branch to bring enforcement action. So a state prosecutor doing this is usurping the authority of the federal executive branch. I think that should be a much bigger constitutional issue than it's been. But what should really trouble people about this is that Congress not only created these campaign finance laws, they also created a second body, that is to say, one other than the Justice Department, to enforce this, and that's the Federal Election Commission. The reason Congress did that is because it wants uniform enforcement of the campaign finance laws across the country. And what you have here is the two federal authorities who actually have jurisdiction over this both looked at it in connection with Trump and decided not to bring any enforcement action against him because the expenditures that we're talking about here are simply, technically speaking, not campaign expenditures. So if you have a state prosecutor who comes in and now decides he's going to enforce federal law, two things are problematic about that. One, it violates the idea that the law should be enforced uniformly by the federal authorities across the board, the same way across the country. So he's violating that. But the second thing is he's making it up as he goes along. I mean, these are not, technically speaking, this is not, you know, paying the hush money to the porn star, as salacious and interesting as that all is, it's not a campaign expenditure. The
but
fact
is Bragg,
that she,
Andy, wait, is Bragg's argument, though, okay, yes, it was a federal campaign finance violation. Fine. Whatever it was, doesn't matter. I'm charging him with falsifying business records, which I can do as a prosecutor, at a state level, because the issue that he's saying is at the state level, I'm accusing you of falsifying business records, regardless of why. Is that sort of what he's insisting is his authority?
No. Jessica, if that were what he was doing, you're right. It would be completely unobjectionable.
Okay.
But the thing is, in New York law, there's two crimes, right? There's the misdemeanor of falsifying business records, which you just basically alluded to, right? Then there's the felony. The extra element to prove the felony is that you have to prove that a person's fraudulent intent in falsifying business records was to conceal the commission of another crime.
Okay.
And
right.
What he's saying is the other crime is a federal campaign finance violation that he doesn't have the authority to enforce.
Got it. Okay. Thank you for that clarity. So before I let you go, I think the former president mentioned you by name this past week, almost every day, to make his case outside of court that, you know, this shouldn't be brought. This case shouldn't be tried. Your name along with others. But how did that feel?
Well, I've been through this ringer before. So like some weeks I'm a genius and other weeks I'm an idiot. So I've kind of let it roll off my back. I've been doing this for a long time. And, you know, as a prosecutor for a very long time, I've been very fortunate to be able to stay involved in the issues that I care about in this kind of second career I've had for the last 20 years. But I've always tried to call it the way I see it. And sometimes that gets the former president very aggravated at me. And sometimes he likes it. But I think that from my perspective, you know, I just have to try to be as accurate as I can be. This, for example, is a dog's breakfast of a case. The Florida indictment, to the contrary, I don't think you'll hear President Trump singing my praises, because I've said any number of times, I think that's a very, very serious case. So, you know, like you do, like all of us try to do, we call it as we see it the best we can. We do the best we can. And, you know, if people like it, that's nice. If they get upset by it, but they get upset for the wrong reasons, you can't get too whipped up about it.
You're like a poll, Andy. You know, sometimes you give good numbers, sometimes you give bad numbers. You know, what can you do?
Right. Well, as long as they think I don't have my thumb on the scale, I'm good.
Right. Andy McCarthy, thank you so much for joining.
Thanks, Jessica. Appreciate it.
That'll do it for this edition of the Fox News Rundown from Washington. Tomorrow, Mike Emanuel will speak with former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy to get his take on the current state of Capitol Hill and effort to vacate the current Speaker Mike Johnson. Plus, Fox News contributor Dr. Nicole Sapphire discusses what could be behind the surge of cancer cases among young adults. I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Thanks for listening to the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
Stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
Hey, it's Clay Travis. Join me for Outkick the Show as we dive deep into a mix of topics. New episodes available Monday to Friday on your favorite podcast platform, and watch directly on outkick.com/watch.